Please keep in mind, responses provided on the program are merely intended to offer guidance and should not be construed as legal advice. We cannot cover the specifics of any individual situation sufficiently to know what the most prudent course of action is, so NARSOL advises all participants to consult with an attorney in their jurisdiction to determine the best course of action.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of NARSOL in Action. And good evening across the, what is they used to say, the fruited plains and from coast to coast. Due to legislative session and other distractions, it's been several months since we've had a conference call of this nature, and it's gratifying to see we have well over 100 signed up, which means one or two possibilities. The first is that everyone misses my soothing, compassionate voice and couldn't wait to sign up. The more likely truth is that we have a great guest and important subject matter on tonight's agenda. And we would welcome some assistance in planning and promoting future calls, so contact us if you're interested. You hear Andy working diligently in the background. He's the co-host of the Registry Matters podcast, and he's assisting, as always, this evening with production and hopefully making the program run smoothly. During the first hour, we'll be discussing the case of Murphy versus Rowell, recently decided by the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. Hour two will be, can they do that? And during that hour, we'll try to answer your questions about whether a probation officer or registry tracking official can impose requirements on you. Sometimes they just invent things, and we're going to discuss anything that you want to ask about, can they do it? And hour three will be a conversation with the NARSOL Board of Directors, which is an opportunity for you to hopefully ask some questions and make a short statement about what you'd like to see NARSOL doing, or what we're not doing, or what we're doing well. And as always, when we have these long programs, there's a 5-minute break at the top of each hour so you can stretch and do whatever you need to do without missing anything important. You'll hear some spots and promos that we're running, and then we'll hear that same news sounder again when we start the next segment. And we plan to award some prizes this evening, at least a couple, depends on how the spirit moves me, maybe more, but at least a couple of prizes. And those of you who signed up would have gotten the phone number, but if you didn't sign up, you can still enter the contest by texting 747-227-4477. And you can just text anything that says prize or enter, so we'll have your number. And Andy will give you a contestant number, which will be 3 digits. And when we have the drum roll and we pick the prize winner, that 3-digit will be announced, and we will have you text us back, winner, rather than trying to find you on the telephone board, because it's going to be hard to find anybody tonight. So we will confirm, and you will, if you haven't entered, we'll confirm that you've been entered, and we're going to be giving away a registration to the NARSOL conference and a gift card. And if you've already paid to registration, we can either carry it over to next year, or it will be transferable to a future conference. So now we're done with housekeeping. Let's get on with what everybody came for, which is to talk about a case. So let me introduce Adele Nicholas, who'll be with us for the first hour, and we might have to stretch that depending on how many questions, for the first hour of tonight's program. Ms. Nicholas is a Chicago-based civil rights attorney who has extensively litigated issues concerning registration and related collateral consequences in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Among her recent notable cases are Hoffman versus the Village of Pleasant Prairie, in which the court enjoined enforcement of municipal residence restrictions that sought to force registrants to move out of the village, and Winter versus Schmitz, in which the court prohibited the state of Illinois from labeling a registrant as a sexual predator based on a misdemeanor conviction. Welcome again, Ms. Nicholas, and thank you for being here tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
We have had you here before, but it's been a long time.
Probably over a year.
So I never did ask you last time. There's a special individual that becomes attorney and an attorney. And some people say they're all chasing the almighty dollar, but that's not the reason. So what inspired you to become an attorney?
Well, it was a long time ago. So I'm trying to think back. I guess that I worked at a legal magazine while I was an undergrad, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do after my undergrad, but I really enjoyed working at this magazine, was interested in the topics, interested in the people that we spoke to, and so that kind of inspired me to go to law school. And then when I was in law school, I decided that it was really important to me to represent people and help people with legal problems that they had, and so that's what led me to where I am today.
Well, you have you've been doing a lot in this area, and I read your brief bio, but it doesn't begin to tell the story of your work. I mean, the group in Illinois is constantly sending me stuff about a case, and I say, guys, I can't even keep track of all the stuff that's going in. It's not just Illinois; it's the other two states. So, can you tell us how many civil rights cases that you're involved in? It's either lead counsel or co-counsel that specifically deal with sex offender issues.
Sure. My colleague Mark Weinberg and I have been working on these issues for about, 4 years now. So it's been a big part of our practice. How many open cases we have, I'm not quite sure, but several. We're working on cases in Wisconsin concerning GPS monitoring, in Illinois concerning the case we're here to talk about tonight, the imprisonment of people who can't find housing that the IDOC will approve. We've done several cases about residency restrictions here in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. A couple of cases about just some of the other collateral issues that occur here in Illinois. So probably at least 10 or 12 cases.
And for those who listen to these calls so that regularly, we always tell people these are enormous undertakings, but we'll get to that later. We want to focus tonight on the case that we mentioned in the introduction to the program. What is the difference between a class action and individual as opposed to an individual action? We get this all the time. So when you file a class action, you just walk into the courthouse and you have a little red stamp and you put class action and hand it to the court clerk, and that takes care of it, right?
Not exactly. So here we did an injunctive class action, which is a special kind of class action where you're not asking for money damages on behalf of the class, but you're asking for a class-wide injunction, meaning a court order that would tell the defendant to stop doing something that they've been doing or that they're required to do something that they haven't done yet. And that injunction would be on behalf of everybody who is affected by a government policy that we allege to be unconstitutional. So that's how this case proceeded. We started the case with 6 named plaintiffs. Ultimately, we had 4 named plaintiffs who the court found had standing to represent the whole class. And then the case was certified by the judge as a class action because there were approximately 250 individuals who were currently in the situation that we were challenging in the case, which was they were imprisoned beyond their release dates because they could not find a place to live that the Department of Corrections would approve. And they were facing a particularly bad situation of potential lifetime imprisonment because their MSR time would never start to run because they had this sentence of 3 years to life of MSR. And due to several quirks and intricacies of Illinois law, they ended up serving this time with no end in sight.
For those who are not familiar with the jargon, the MSR is mandatory supervised release that follows.
Yes.
Can we focus just a little bit on the certification process? Because I was being funny that all you do is just stamp with red letters class action. What does it take to certify a class and some of the complexities where people will understand that you just don't stamp it with red?
Sure. Well, I mean, at the beginning, you do just kind of make the allegations that it should be that it should proceed as a class. So when you file your complaint, you say this is a case on behalf of these 4 people who seek to represent a class of everyone else who's similarly situated. And then how do you show that the case should actually proceed as a class? Well, you have to file something called a motion for class certification, which the judge then considers. And there's I guess there are six total factors that the court has to take into account. The first one is that there's a sufficiently large number of people who are affected by the policy that you're challenging. So in our case, we didn't have any problem showing that because the state agreed that there were approximately 250 people who were having the problem that we'd identified. And then you have to show the court that common issues of fact and law affect everybody who's in your class. So that means that you could resolve their problem on a class-wide basis because it's not about whether something bad happened to a particular individual, but whether this policy that's being applied the same way to everyone violates their constitutional rights without too much attention having to be given to each individual person's circumstances. You have to show that the claims brought by your named plaintiffs are typical of the claims of everyone in the class, meaning that they don't have some kind of unusual fact pattern that makes their claim different from the people they seek to represent. And then finally, you have to show that your class representatives and class counsel will adequately represent the interests of the class. So that means that you have named plaintiffs who are serious about doing this and seeing it through the end, and that you have counsel who have the necessary experience and expertise to in pursuing their claims. And then finally, from the injured class, you just have to show that the class action is, I can't remember the exact terms used for it, but for practical purposes, that the class action is the best way to resolve the problem because the defendant, the person you're suing, the government, has acted in a way that affects everyone in the class. So if you make all of those showings, the defendant, whoever you're suing, has a chance to respond and object. And then the court conducts an analysis of those factors and decides whether the case should proceed as a class.
And you did get certified.
We did.
We're getting a little bit of garbling. Andy, I'm going to pause for a minute and ask you, is this just something I'm hearing, or are we getting this system-wide?
It's happening system-wide, but I think it's resolved at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, these types of challenges can be very expensive to undertake because experience has shown that the states fight back with virtually unlimited resources. How has your firm been able to underwrite the direct expenses as well as the massive amount of billable hours that accumulate in these protracted litigation that you're involved in? You do have to pay overhead, right?
There certainly is a lot of risk that goes into litigating a case like this. The biggest thing is the amount of time we put into it without any compensation. So we don't know whether we'll eventually get paid. We hope to get paid through a federal law called Section 1988, which basically says that a prevailing party in a civil rights suit, so proves that the defendant violated their constitutional rights, the violator of the constitutional rights should have to pay their attorney's fees. So that's how we get paid in a case like this. But it is a lot of work. You know, sometimes we put in 3 or more years of work, and it's a risk because if you don't win, not only do you lose all the time you put in, but whatever funds you had to put in to do things like file the case, take depositions, obtain transcripts of depositions, all the travel we did to visit with our clients and interview people who were affected by these policies. So it can be a lot of risk. For us, with this case, we really believed in it. We believed that it was a very serious constitutional violation that was affecting a lot of people, and it just couldn't stand. Fortunately, it seems like that was a good decision.
Well, it certainly is. You're certainly on the right side of the inevitable appeal, probably. But what is the actual issue that we're trying to remedy in this case? Let's try to focus on the mandatory supervised release and then try to distinguish it from discretionary parole, because there's going to be a lot of confusion about my loved one didn't get out of prison. So what are we actually trying to fix here?
Yes, great question. So every state is a little bit different in how it administers post-release supervision. In Illinois, we have everyone who gets a sentence to prison for a felony gets two separate sentences, a sentence of imprisonment and a sentence of mandatory supervised release. Mandatory supervised release serves some of the same functions as parole. You know, for instance, you have a parole agent who is your supervising officer while you're out. You have to comply with conditions and be on things like GPS monitoring, comply with basically what your parole agent tells you to do and restrictions that you're given. But it's very different from traditional parole because it is not early release from a sentence that you haven't finished. It is a separate sentence of community supervision. So in Illinois, the amount of mandatory supervised release a person receives is set by statute. And for certain convictions, the law here in Illinois imposes a mandatory indeterminate term of MSR. By that, I mean it's this indeterminate amount of time a person will have to spend on MSR in the community of 3 years to life. Another section of Illinois law states that for any time a person remains in prison while on this 3-to-life term of MSR will toll the running of the time. So if a person is revoked for some reason, their MSR time stops running. The problem our clients had and hundreds of other people were also having is that they couldn't find a place to live that the Department of Corrections would approve. And because they couldn't find a place to live, they were deemed to be in technical violation of the rules of their supervised release. And so they were revoked, quote unquote, although they never actually left the prison. So people were, and still are, being detained in prison beyond their mandatory release date. And that time is counting for nothing. It's not starting to run. They're not receiving any credit for it. It's just simply they're sitting there in prison, considered to be in violation of their MSR. And it was very often, more often than not, through no fault of their own. It was simply because if you didn't have sufficient funds to pay for private housing that complies with all of the burdensome rules and regulations about where someone can live while they're on MSR for a sex offense, the IDOC just won't let you out. So that's the situation that our clients found themselves in. And it's particularly frightening because unlike for a person who has a determinate amount of MSR, for instance, a year or 2 years or 3 years, someone with this 3 years to life can never max out their time. So people were potentially serving life sentences that no criminal judge imposed on them simply because they were unable to identify housing.
So what agency actually imposes these conditions of mandatory supervised release? How do they get these? When they're ready to leave or getting near the end of their sentence, I'm assuming they get some notification of here are your conditions. Who decrees those conditions?
Yeah, so I'd say there's three entities involved in the conditions of MSR that people in Illinois face. They're formally given a list of conditions by the Prisoner Review Board, or also called the Parole Board. However, those conditions aren't really decided upon by the parole board as much as they are imposed by statute. So there is a long list of statutory restrictions that everyone on MSR has to comply with. And there is a list that's particular to people who've been convicted of sex offenses, have a special set of statutory restrictions. So the first source of these restrictions is Illinois law. You know, the lawmakers of Illinois. The second is the PRB, which imposes the statutorily required conditions along with any other conditions it deems necessary based on the individual's circumstances or their offense or where they'll be paroling to. And then finally, the Department of Corrections itself, through its parole department, can impose what are essentially parole conditions on people. They call these instructions. So technically, a parole agent is only supposed to give instructions that are consistent with the conditions set by the PRB. But in reality, the instructions that are given by the parole department can be very onerous in and of themselves and can impose additional barriers to people's ability to find housing.
Can you give us some examples of some of the barriers that prevent people from being released? And let's see how those correlate with my state and other states. What keeps people in prison?
Sure. So many of the restrictions are familiar to people anywhere. There are geographical restrictions. In Illinois, there is a rule that anyone who's been convicted of a child sex offense may not live within 500 feet of a school, a playground, or a daycare, including home daycares. That rule is generally applied by the Illinois Department of Corrections to anyone who is on parole for a sex offense of any kind, even if it wasn't against a child. There is additional parole restrictions on housing, including not being allowed to live near a beach, a movie theater, or other types of places where they believe children may congregate. There are restrictions that for a long time have been imposed just by the Department of Corrections. For instance, people were not allowed to live somewhere that had internet access. People are not allowed to live anywhere where children also live or where children visit. People are not, they must live somewhere that has a landline phone. The Department of Corrections prefers a landline phone for electronic home detention. And then there's a lot of decisions that are just simply in the hands of the parole agent, including if they don't want you to live at a residence with a dog, they're free to impose that restriction. In my estimation, it's not sufficiently constrained what the parole agent can decide on when they go to investigate a place. For instance, if someone even has photographs of their own children or grandchildren in the location, that could be enough for the parole agent to say the house can't be approved because of the presence of that. Or, for instance, toys or other children's items could be enough for a site to be rejected.
Sounds like it could be potentially whimsical to each parole agent who does the site inspection.
It is a serious problem, the amount of discretion that's in the hands of the individual parole agent. And that's something that I think we really came to understand through litigating this case, is that it varies greatly depending on who does the investigation and what they, what that individual takes into account. I guess another restriction that we should talk about is there's a statutory restriction on anyone who is on MSR for a sex offense from living in the same building or apartment complex as a person who's been who is on the registry. The DOC, up until very recently, was also applying that restriction to trailer parks. So someone who was seeking a host site to live at while on MSR was not permitted to parole to a trailer that was in a trailer park where another registrant lives, even though that is not required by Illinois law. But the one good thing to already come from this case is that the Department of Corrections has withdrawn that rule. And so now people are permitted to go to trailer parks, even if another registrant lives there.
Oh, well, I'm nearing the end of my question, but I'm going to ask you about, I read the opinion, most of it. I didn't read the background on all the plaintiffs because it was quite detailed. But the court noted that a particular plaintiff, Paul Murphy, the court noted that he's indigent and homeless, and he was originally convicted of possession of child porn in 2012. And received a probated sentence. And now 5 years after his release date and nearly twice the number of years of his sentence, he remains incarcerated because the Department of Corrections cannot find a place for him. But did the, we've covered the supervised release sufficiently, so I'll skip that part of the question, but did the fact that the clock does not start ticking until the offender can get out of prison, how heavily do you think that weighed in the ruling? Because like in my state, they are getting credit, which is equally appalling to me that you can serve all your time and have a 5 to 20 year or 5 to life. The 5 to 20 years, you could conceivably serve 20 years and get out. But these guys could never get out if they can't find housing. Do you think that was a significant fact that the court considered?
I think it had to play a role, although that was not specifically the basis of the judge's decision. It did play a role that for someone like Mr. Murphy, who's older and doesn't have family that he is in touch with, doesn't have friends on the outside, and doesn't have any assets of his own, the situation is just so dire, because he has no way of getting the funds to go somewhere outside of prison. And so he was just potentially facing, you know, the rest of his life behind bars on a sentence that, you know, was originally probation.
It's really, really appalling. What happens next in this case? Because I'm going to try to get at least a half an hour for callers. What happens next? Will the state appeal? What will anybody get released? Where are we going with this next?
So we're very heartened by some developments we've had over the past week, really, which is that the state, you know, the attorneys who we've been working with on this case have reached out to us and said they have. They're interested in reaching a solution to this problem. So we've agreed, and they've agreed to engage in a voluntary process with the judge, Judge Kendall, who ruled on our motion. So I guess we didn't actually say what the decision was in the case, which was that Judge Kendall found that this whole scheme of keeping people imprisoned indefinitely because they can't find somewhere to live, violates their constitutional rights under the Eighth Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause. And the basis of her reasoning for that is that it's essentially punishing them for their poverty, which is a violation of their constitutional rights. So based on that, the state wants to sit down with us and engage in a process to come up with solutions that will actually give these people an opportunity to identify places outside of prison to serve their MSR. So we're encouraged by that. It could take a lot of forms. We have some ideas of what would be potential solutions, but we won't know for another couple of weeks what's going to be achievable without legislative change. Because, you know, as of right now, the judge has basically ordered, you can't do this. But what she hasn't said is, here's what you have to do to fix it. So that's what we're hoping to achieve. And we have our first meeting with them, with, you know, the representatives of the state and with the judge a week from yesterday, May 1st.
So, well, I'm going to conclude my questioning. And we have an unusually large number of attorneys on tonight. I'm going to go ahead and unmute. I know Janice is here, and I'm getting ready to unmute you right now. And then any other attorney that wants to ask a more directed legal question, go ahead and I'm going to switch to this is the complicated thing here is we have a bunch of mics to reopen as soon as I switch from lecture to Q&A. But any other attorney that would like to ask a question specifically, I'm going to allow the attorneys to go first. But now, attorneys, you love to talk, so try to ask a very concise question so we can get to as many people that are waiting to ask questions that are from Illinois. So I'm switching to Q&A. Andy, are you ready to do the opening the mics of everybody who has to be reopened?
Q&A session has started. Muted.
I've got Janice unmuted. Welcome, Janice. Janice, can you hear us? Well, her mic is open. If she does get back, she may be stepped away.
Larry?
Yes.
Larry? Hi, this is Janice Bellucci. Did you just mention my name?
I did. I said that I'm unmuting attorneys and I recognize that you're here. So did you have a question for Adele and any other attorneys that want to get in the queue? We're gonna
sure, let I do. Attorneys. Of course. So,
hi, Janice. Welcome to the call.
Well, thank you. And I really sincerely want to thank Adele for taking on such an important and huge issue in the state of Illinois. I only became aware of this about a year ago, the issue. And when I first found out about it, I quite frankly couldn't even believe it. But I will say, or having said that, I will say that this is how people who are considered sexually violent predators are treated in California as well. So even the ones that are considered healed and ready to reenter into society, they still can't get out unless, I guess, similar to what's happening there in Illinois, you've got to be able to prove that you have a place to live. So I guess I'd like to ask Adele, though. Adele, what would you say has been the biggest challenge for you in this lawsuit so far?
I think the biggest challenge was putting together a convincing case for the judge that was comprehensible, because it's not one law or policy that you can point to. It's an extremely complicated overlapping scheme of laws, regulations, policies, unwritten policies, just the way things have been done, that all, when you put it together, it creates this impossible situation for our clients. So I think that some, you know, other attorneys have worked hard on this issue too, but where their cases ultimately weren't able to succeed is that I think a judge is able to point to maybe one star in this constellation of laws and regulations and say, well, that in and of itself is reasonable and rational, and it's designed to protect the public and foster people's success on MSR. So we, I think that was a big challenge to put together a broad enough case that really explained how all of these complex systems were interacting.
So,
I think you did a great job doing that.
Thanks.
Janice, I'm going to leave you unmuted as long as you're on a quiet background in case you have to anything else to interject. Any other attorney, star six will get you in the queue. And I've got one in the queue right now, so I'm assuming this is an attorney. So go ahead, you're on Narsil in Action. Are you a legal professional? Christian, 847 area code. We're either having a problem or he can't hear us. Okay, well, let's move on. Anyone in the general audience, if you would like to ask a question for Ms. Nicholas, star six will get you in the queue if everything's working correctly. We would ask that if you're in a state other than Illinois, we'll try to give Illinois callers preference. So Illinois residents or people connected with this issue in Illinois, go ahead, hit star six, and we'll start taking questions. So I got another one here that says, Mason, you're on Narsil in Action, area code 815.
Hi, Adele. My name is Jesse. I was recently in De La Ville with quite a few of these, matter of fact, probably all of the people that you're talking about that was in this case. So I've been following it for a few years. I'm out now. I'm in Ottawa, Illinois. And my question, I guess, would be this three to life, for instance. Is it going to possibly change the life part? Are you guys trying to get that thrown out so we can be on, you know, 3 years parole and get on with our life?
Well, I anticipated that this would be the first and probably the most frequent question. And the real answer is that no, this case does not get rid of the three to life amount of supervision. It's harder to challenge that from a legal standpoint. And this case did not attack that. This case attacks the fact that people can't get out of prison on MSR. So we are monitoring the process for people to actually finish this term of MSR. So what does it take to actually petition to terminate your supervision? And we're interested in that issue and we're watching it. In terms of whether we have a legal challenge to the constitutionality of three to life supervision, no. At this point, it's still intact.
Okay. Thank you.
So, all right. Thank you. And I'm going to put that one back on mute. I have opened the microphone for Attorney King Alexander, who's going to be with us in the second hour. Can you hear us, King?
I can hear you. I don't know if you can hear me.
We can hear you fine. And then we've got one that says Oregon Judicial Department on here. I don't know if that person wants to ask a question, but I'm assuming that's an attorney. So Oregon Judicial Department, did you have any comments or anything before we go to the rest of the
people? I don't have any questions.
Okay,
thank you. No, I don't have any questions. I'm just listening in. Thanks.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to begin going to callers. Some people, I won't be able to give your area code because it's not giving it to me. So I'm going to, I know this next one is an old area code, 312. You're on Narsil in Action. Anybody who would like to ask a question, hit star six and we'll get to you as quick as you can. So go ahead, area code 312.
Can you hear me?
You're going to have to speak up just a tad.
I said hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you if you maintain that posture.
Okay. Hello, Adele. It's Will from Illinois. How are you?
Hi, well, thanks. How are you?
Good. So my question for you is, I know that this lawsuit and this decision was pretty narrowly focused on the Tree to Life issue, but in the decision and in the statements made by the judge, it just seems like that there are elements that might be able to translate into other lawsuits or other efforts that we're doing. Can you talk a little bit about how you think that this decision and the comments made by the judge might help in other lawsuits or efforts that we're doing?
So I think that's an excellent question, because it's true that the judge's decision was based on this concept of punishing someone for their poverty. And that applies not only to people who have indeterminate MSR, but it applies equally to people who have determinate terms of MSR who end up having to run out that time in prison simply because they can't afford a place to live. So we're hopeful, we haven't discussed this matter with the state yet, but we are hopeful that they will recognize that any relief that's granted in this case should also benefit those folks, because there's a lot of people who are in that situation. At any given time, there's probably 1,200 to 1,300 people was the last estimate that I saw who are stuck in IDOC on their MSR time simply because of a lack of housing. So I think that that language will definitely be helpful here. And then, I'm sure I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I'm sure there are other applications, where these laws do come down really harshly on people who just simply don't have the funds to find a place to live or, other things. So the language may be helpful there too.
Does that take care of you, Will? I guess it does.
Yep, that was.
Oops, sorry about that, Will. I got a little too quick on the button, but you're going to be back on in the third hour. Christian, I'm going back to you. It looks like you're back in the queue. Go ahead. You're on Arsenal in Action.
Hi, yes, this is Christine, and I just want to first say, Adele and Mark, you guys did a great job. I'm very happy of the outcome that it came out, and I appreciate everything that you guys did. I do have a brother that's in there. He is only doing the 3 years MSR right now, and he's supposed to be released in January. Does he still have to do the MSR after he gets released, or is that counting towards his getting out?
Does he have a determinate amount of MSR? Does he have a...
He's got 3 years.
Out?
He's only got 3 years, and he's got 3 years of MSR, and he's supposed to really be released January 17, 2020.
So if he's maxing out his time, if he has a determinate amount of MSR, so for instance, if he had a sentence at, at 50%, that MSR time also runs at 50%. And so if he has 3 years and he does the year and a half or, the 85% of his 3 years, whatever's required by his sentence, he's going to be done and he does not have MSR after that.
Okay. That's what I wanted to make sure. Because I am picking him up at Taylorville, and I know there's a lot of gentlemen out in Taylorville. I keep in touch with all the family, pretty much most of the family members that are in Taylorville right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I just want to say thank you again, Adele. You are amazing, and so is Mark, and so is Scott from Illinois Voice. I would not have been made it through this whole ordeal without you guys. I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Oh, again, I jumped the queue there too quickly. thank you for, they stay on the call. I just silenced the microphone. If we have every microphone open, it would be so loud you couldn't hear a Mack truck. So I'm going to take the call. The queue is full, so I'm going to try to move expeditiously through. Area code 847, you're on Arsenal in Action.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Brian. I'm a resident of Northwest Suburbs of Illinois. With Adele, this might be a little bit outside the scope here. I've been trying to follow a little bit. Back in 2016-17, I believe at the time Governor Rauner formed a task force to look at the possibilities of changing the registration laws. And allowing people to get off the registry. Is your firm doing any kind of work in regards to trying to assist with that, or to help, I guess, enact these laws or get these laws enacted or anything like that?
Well, it's a great question. As far as I know, nothing has come of the task force recommendations, which is...
Yeah, I noticed that myself.
Yeah, it's disappointing, but I guess, you know, someone else might disagree with me, but I was always pessimistic that anything would happen from this process. I thought it was a good idea and a good process, and I thought some of the recommendations that came from it were not bad, but I think I'm preaching to the choir here, but it's a pretty tall order to get legislators to take any action on these issues when there's always the political risk that it will look like they're being soft on crime or, you know, something of that nature. Correct. So, so as far as I know, there's really not anything that's come out of that. Although we'd certainly, be supportive of efforts to reform some of these laws. But I know our affiliate, Illinois Voices is interested in these issues and monitoring them closely. And so if they call upon us, we will try to help with those efforts as much as we can.
Thank you for the question.
Awesome. Thank you.
I see several wireless callers, and I'm gonna get to the wireless callers. And there's a one here named David, so it's gonna be David, Don, and then the wireless callers. So David, you're next. You're on Marcel in Action. Go ahead. Area code 646. We're gonna come.
Sorry,
back
I was on
David.
Mute. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Okay. Great. I have two questions, actually. First, do you know how many states have a setup similar to Illinois where the residency requirements are keeping people in jail indefinitely? So, like, what's the scope of the application of this to other states? And second, do you think this might have ramifications for the debates over civil commitment, where, again, people are, after their sentence, being kept indefinitely? In that case, supposedly because they're still getting treatment, but in some states, no one ever gets out of these, and the treatment is either basically non-existent or ineffective. So do you see any link with those sets of issues? Thank you.
Yeah, both are good questions. So with regard to other states, someone should do, a 50-state survey of how these issues play out. What we know for sure is that there are many states where there's been a recognition that people have to be released from prison after they finish their sentences. So in Wisconsin, for instance, if someone can't find a place to stay, they're allowed to use a shelter as their address, and they're on GPS monitoring. And the Department of Corrections in Wisconsin considers that sufficient to monitor the person. Similarly, we know, Minnesota allows people, to get out of prison even if they don't have an approved place to stay. We are aware of some litigation in New York that's similar to ours, which is that people are not released if they lack an approved housing. But off the top of my head, those are the three additional states I can think of that I really know about with enough confidence to tell you what's happening. But I would be very interested to see how this is playing out nationwide. And then in terms of the civil commitment question, yes, I think many of the questions here are very pertinent to the situations of people who are on civil commitment. I think, as Janice mentioned earlier, some people who've been civilly committed are eventually deemed to have, recovered, or they're better. They should be released, and then yet the state still continues to hold them in something that's essentially prison, unless and until they find a place to live. So I think a lot of the principles articulated by Judge Kendall in her decision should be applicable to those situations too, where they arise, whether it's here in Illinois or elsewhere.
That's a great, great question. And since we're talking about states that may be similar, we're going to go to one where I think there is a similarity. We got a question from Don. Don, you're on Marcel in Action. Go ahead.
Thank you. Larry, I was going to ask, I know this is probably outside of what we're talking, the subject, but say a person has money to be able to, get a place. We're having trouble with, it seems like I see people that they have to have a sponsor to be able to parole out to a housing. It would be nice if they could, if they found a house or apartment, should I say, to be able to rent it and being able to parole to that apartment. Are you having any problems with people who do have the money and the means to be able to parole to an apartment without a sponsor?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's still incredibly difficult to locate a place. Even people who do have means struggle greatly. And I've talked to many families that are in that situation where their imprisoned loved one does have enough money to pay for a place. It's just they're submitting address after address after address, and they're being rejected for sometimes quixotic reasons that are difficult to understand. So, yes, we face that problem here. And I think that's got to be part of the conversation that we have here in Illinois, is what process is going to be put in place to make it easier for people to find and get approval for housing.
And Don, that's a great question, because it is a similar problem. People don't have money, of course, face much higher barrier because they can't even present an address. But people who have all these erected barriers that are either statutorily or administrative or the whims of the PO, the parole agent, you end up with people who could be out of prison, but they're not. And that's a tragedy in the United States to have that happening. So, Don, we are very much looking at the similarities and considering such litigation in our state. So, and thanks for listening and being on the show, Don.
Thank you.
So we're going to go, I'm going to area code 916 on a wireless. It says wireless, no name. You're on Arsenal in Action.
Hey, thank you very much, Adele, for what you're doing. You're instilling a lot of hope in a lot of people. My name is Mike. I'm on MSR, the extended MSR. I've been out for 5 years. And I just wanted to offer any assistance that I could as far as what you said earlier about monitoring the release process. I'm having a great deal of trouble getting answers from my parole agents. I've had 4 different agents in the 5 years that I've been out. And, as you can imagine, you have to build a rapport with these people, and it takes a great deal of time. So I just wanted to tell you that just thank you for everything, and if you need any help, I would love to help you.
Thanks very much. I mean, I'm happy to talk to people who are currently on MSR just about the process and what their circumstances are in terms of trying to get off MSR, because there is theoretically a process in place that we're aware of in the Department of Corrections, but we're not clear on to what extent it's being followed, how it's being administered, and how it's affecting people when they're in your type of position. They've been out for 4 or 5, or more years, and they're still on MSR. So feel free to, give me a call later this week or next week if you'd like to talk it over.
Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, yeah, that'd be great.
We're going to go to another wireless caller. This one's from area code 309. You're on Arsenal Action.
Hi. My question is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. When I first heard about this decision, I was really happy, for the people who were affected. But for me, as a registered sex offender in Illinois who is not on MSR or anything like that, one of the things that I was buoyed about was I thought that it might perhaps spur the legislature to have to take up this issue and maybe also take up, for example, some of the other issues that the person you talked about the task force talked about earlier. And so earlier in your comments, you had mentioned that there was this upcoming meeting with, I guess, opposing counsel or something with regard to a solution. And you had mentioned something about maybe a legislative solution, but then you had also mentioned something about maybe they were going to try to make some accommodations and things like that. So my question is, what do you think the prospects are that this issue will be addressed, you know, by the legislature, or do you think that, you know, this is going to be solely, you know, dealt with outside of that process?
So
thank you for that.
Yeah, it is a good question. I'm always pessimistic that legislators will take any action unless they're forced to, but it very well could be that after this conciliation process we're going through with them, that the result is an order from the judge that makes enforcement of some of these laws no longer valid, which would require a legislative change. I'm not sure to what extent that's going to happen, and we'll know a lot more next week after we sit down with everyone. But whether the legislature will take this up voluntarily, I'm a little doubtful.
Well, we're going to try to zip through one more call and give you some opportunity to make closing comments, unless you, of course, would like to stay over. So we got we're going to go to area code 847. I know this should be an Illinois call. You're on Darcel in Action.
Hi, how are you?
Try to make it an expeditious question.
Good. Okay, it's not so much a question as it is some aid. The caller from Ottawa, I think, was asking about the task force report, the Sex Offenses and Sex Offender Registration Task Force. Something I'm on MSR and 3 years to life, and something I've brought up in our mandatory group meetings and have not gotten a lot of success with is that to try to get something through, we all have to contact our local legislatures and start talking about this. And I've had some luck with my local legislator. He's new. He was just elected. And probably if you have a new elected legislator or representative or senator in your area, they may be receptive to speaking about it. Mine is. He's very interested in this report. And I've had a meeting with him, and I hope to have more meetings with him. And I think it's really important that we all take a part in our own environment that we live in, and we can do that really seriously by picking up the phone and calling our legislators, and do it often to keep reminding them that we're here. This doesn't happen by accident. So we have to help out. We can't, I mean, Adele and Mark work very hard, but I think we can help them a lot with this stuff if we get involved. So that's really all I wanted to say, because I think this task force report is really important. And actually the 3 years to life, one caller earlier asked if the 3 years to life, people who are on 3 years to life MSR and they're living out in the world now, what's going to happen with that? This task force addresses that. You know, so if you're really interested in getting off, make the phone call and let's help ourselves.
So thank you for that. We're rolling into a hard break. I'm going to hear lovely music playing in a moment. But Adele, did you have any summation or wrap up you want to make before that lovely music starts?
I don't think so. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to come on and share some info about the case and keep up the fight.
Well, we are delighted to have you here, and we will send out an email after the conference call and provide information of people who would like to contact you, and so you can follow up if you have a relevant question about the situation in Illinois. We're going to be back after a 5-minute break to take up the second hour with King Alexander. With Can They Do That? We hope everybody will stay with us, and we appreciate you being here this evening, and you're listening to Narsil in Action.